The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening and welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Bill Sasso and I am the chairman of the Free Library Foundation Board of Directors and a proud supporter of this great institution. And I am very pleased to welcome you all here tonight and thank you for your support of the Free Library. Before we begin, one housekeeping item, please take out your cell phones and make sure they are turned off. Thank you. And I also wanted to remind you that a book signing will take place upstairs in the lobby following tonight's event. If you haven't explored the Free Library in a while, I encourage you to discover all we have to offer in addition to our wonderful author series event tonight. Coming up on April 11th through April 16th is the library's fifth annual Philadelphia Book Festival, featuring author events, musical performance, and interactive programming for all the children. Our firm, Stradley Ronan Stevens & Young, is proud to be a sponsor this year of this great organization and this great event. And for a complete list of all the festival events, please check out freelibrary.org/festival. But tonight, it is my pleasure to introduce the acclaimed journalist and best-selling author, Cokie Roberts. Cokie Roberts is a senior news analyst for NPR News, where she was the congressional correspondent for more than 10 years. In addition to her work for NPR, Roberts is a political commentator for ABC News, providing analysis for all network news programming. From 1996 to 2002, she and Sam Donaldson co-anchored the weekly ABC interview program This Week. And today, she is one of the lead analysts for This Week with Christine Amanpour. In her more than 40 years in broadcasting, she has won countless awards, including three Emmys. She has been inducted into the Broadcasting and Cable Hall of Fame and was cited by the American Women in Radio and Television as one of the 50 greatest women in the history of broadcasting. In addition to her appearances on the airwaves, Cokie, along with her husband, Stephen Roberts, writes a weekly column syndicated in newspapers around the country by United Media. The Roberts are also contributing editors to USA Weekend magazine, and together they wrote From This Day Forward, an account of their more than 40-year marriage and other marriages in American history. Their book immediately went on to the New York Times bestseller list, following Roberts' number one bestseller, We Are Our Mother's Daughters, an account of women's roles and relationships throughout American history. Roberts' Histories of Women in America's Founding Era, Founding Mothers, published in 2004, and Ladies of Liberty in 2008, also became instant bestsellers. Cokie Roberts holds more than 20 honorary degrees, serves on the boards of several nonprofit institutions, and on the President's Commission on Service and Civic Participation. Recently, the Library of Commerce named her a, quote, living legend, end quote, one of the very few Americans to have attained this honor. But she is here tonight, but you are here tonight to hear more about Steve and Cokie's new book, Our Haggadah, which offers a personalized version of the Passover text written especially for use by couples of mixed faith. It is a pleasure to have us here with us tonight, ladies and gentlemen, and please join me in welcoming Cokie Roberts back to Philadelphia.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. What a treat it is to be back at the Philadelphia Free Library. It's such a special, wonderful place. Steve was supposed to be with me tonight, and I have never talked about this book without him. It was bad enough that I, the Shiksa bride, should write the Haggadah, but worse, that he should not be here to talk about it. And I remonstrated with him. You know how far that gets you. And he reminded me that I left him in a much worse lurch when our book on marriage came out. From this day forward, we were in Los Angeles in the middle of, you know, a huge book tour. And ABC called me and said, we've decided to do this week, which I was still anchoring at the time, out of Jerusalem this weekend. And the Pope's going to Jerusalem, and, you know, we've got interviews set up with all the leaders, and you have to go to Jerusalem. Which for me was, you know, basically getting on a plane in L.A. and landing in Tel Aviv, so I felt like I was paying rent, not airfare. Fortunately, I wasn't paying anything. But but that left Steve completing the next few days of the tour, and we did a back and forth as we normally do for this book too. So I'll play both parts, but. It's one thing for me to play his part tonight, which, you know, you'll figure out. But in that book, there was a part where I was explaining how after we got married and we moved to New York, or he was in New York, but I moved to New York, and I was looking for a job, and nobody was hiring me. And I had left a really good job in Washington that paid more than he was making. but we had never discussed it. You know, it was 1966. I was anchoring a Sunday broadcast in Washington. I came full circle, and we never discussed it. I quit my job, moved to New York, and then went around looking for a job and got more and more depressed. As you know, I was at home trying to, I don't know, what was I supposed to do? You know, arrange the flowers or something, and we didn't have enough money for flowers because I didn't have a job. And actually, in New York, that's not a problem because they sell hot flowers on the street. You know, I'm sure they're straight off of graves. But at any rate, seriously. But so I had this this story, which is a totally true story, where I set myself goals every day, so I would get out of bed and go do something so I would be a productive human being until I got a job. And I had job interviews most of these days as well. But so one day I set myself the goal of returning a wedding present that we had received. Now, 1,500 people came to our wedding. More on that later. Only a few of them were from New York. And I had this salad bowl that I wanted to return. And it was from Jorg Jensen. And so I set myself the goal of returning it. And I got up, and I was going to do it. I really was going to do it. I was going to go down to Fifth Avenue and do this. But I couldn't get dressed, and so I didn't. I put my overcoat on over my nightgown, and I went to Jorg Jensen with my salad bowl, and I'm standing there at the return counter, and who is at the return counter? There are 8 million people in the city of New York, the person who gave it to me. Now, it was the guy. It was the guy of the couple, and I realized that if I could get out of there really fast, he wouldn't have no idea that he had given it to me. And so so I say to the person, I'd like to return this. Do you have an account? Oh, sure. You know, of course I had no account. You know, just do this fast. And he, meanwhile, is returning something that he had given his mother, and so he gets on the phone with his wife to say, you know, what should I do instead? And in exchange, and he says, and guess who's here, Cokie? And she says, is she returning a black and white? So I'm totally caught, right? 100% caught. And so I'm trying to be gracious, and he's trying to be gracious. And so to show that there are no hard feelings, he says, well, you know, I'm going right now down the street to Governor Rockefeller's swearing in. His official swearing in is next week, but because of the way the calendar works, he's got to be sworn in before the new year, and he's doing it in his townhouse right here. So why don't you come with me? And I, like an idiot, said, oh, sure, fine, you know, because, again, I'm trying to make it all fine and all that. So we get into the townhouse, and it's 400 degrees, you know. It is 1966 cameras, which are, you know, enormous with these enormous lights, and it is so hot. And everybody is saying to me, can we take your coat? And I keep saying, oh, no, I'm from the South. I'm always cold. And I stood through the ceremony, and then our friend invited me to lunch, and by then I had sense enough to say, no, I'm actually going home. Well, when Steve had to tell that part of the story, he says that he really had a little trouble with, oh, no, I'm from the South. So I am going to try to hold up my end tonight because it can't be as bad as that because this is a Haggadah. It is not anywhere near as personal. It's a prayer book. And so with any luck, I will tell his side of the story without embarrassing him because I'm sure he embarrassed me that night, but nowhere near as much as I had embarrassed myself already. So it was okay. But he is very sorry not to be here because, again, this is such a special institution. His day job is a professor at George Washington University, and they seem to believe that he should actually show up today. So there he is. But he would tell you that we started off on this endeavor of figuring out a way to be married to each other, me, a good Catholic girl, and him, a nice Jewish boy. We met when we were 18 and 19, the summer between our sophomore and junior years of college, and you know, had all these endless, painful conversations about how we were going to work this out, and there was a lot of upset, mainly on his family side. But finally, we did figure it out, and we had a wedding that we tried to make sure everybody felt included at, and it was at my family home, where we still live, and it was after sunset on Saturday night under a chuppah, and my uncle the Jesuit had no choice. He was there as an officiant, and we tried and tried and tried to find a rabbi, but nobody would come. And finally, my mother-in-law said to me, well, Cokie, you know, I find this whole conversation about looking for a rabbi somewhat distasteful. I'm saying, you find it distasteful. I'm the one doing it, you know. But and I was 22. But she said, it really doesn't need to be a rabbi. And in our tradition, it just needs to be a learned man. So why don't you find a learned man, like, say, Arthur Goldberg? And now, Arthur Goldberg was a good friend of my parents. It was not a stretch, but it was sort of an interesting suggestion. And we asked him, and he was kind enough to say yes. My father, at the time, was majority whip of the House of Representatives, Hale Boggs, and the reason we had 1,500 people, which I asked my mother about, because our daughter got married there 31 years later. And by the way, my mother cooked for the whole... Yes, my mother cooked for 1,500 people. And I know, she just turned 95 the other day, so it didn't kill her. But when my daughter got married in the same spot 31 years later, and it did not occur to me to cook. I said to Mama, why did you do that? And she said, it was cheap. And I said, well, then why did we have 1,500 people? Because, you know, I didn't care. I was living off the wedding presents for years. But she said, because I got Daddy on a bad night, And I said to him, Hale, how many people in the House of Representatives do you want to have? And he didn't want to deal, you know. And he said, all the Democrats. Well, that was after the 1964 landslide. And there were 300-some Democrats in the House. So by the time we had them and their spouses and some friendly Republicans and even the true enemy, the Senate, and all the extended family, and then we got to people we actually liked, we were 1,500 people. And so, you know, it was, and the president was there. It was a deal. So I come tripping out the front door to get married. And at this point, my father's kind of urging me on. And my nephew, who at the time was 5, turns around and says to my father, he was the ring bearer, Papa, I lost the ring. And so people start handing me rings, you know, to walk down the grass with. And I go into full 22-year-old drama mode, you know. I can't do it. I can't go on. The symbolism of it all, it's got to be the right ring. And my father looks at me and says, Cokie, don't you think there's enough symbolism going on here for one night? And actually, the president's doctor found the ring with his little ear light. Steve has it now, but he didn't actually have it for the ceremony. I don't know whose ring he got married with. But you know, it's almost 45 years, so whatever. But the but it was important to have the symbolism and to have the symbolism of inclusion and to make the point that we felt strongly that our married life would be one where both of our faith traditions were honored and observed in our home. And so the following spring, since Justice Goldberg, by then United Nations Ambassador Goldberg, had been involved, and he and Mrs. Goldberg, who was wonderful, Dorothy Goldberg, were taking an interest in us, they invited us to their very famous Seder, which was at that point at the Waldorf Astoria, where the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. lives. And so it was my first Seder, and it was wonderful. Off I went, you know, and it was all these interesting people and tuxedoed waiters and all that, and I was mystified through most of it, but I, of course, knew the story of the Exodus, but that was about it. And I recognized a lot of the psalms. They were very much the same psalms that are used in the Easter liturgy. But they finally got to the singing. And since Goldberg had been a labor lawyer for a long time, it was all the old labor and civil rights songs. So I was good at that. But the next year, and so I decided right then and there that that we would always have Passover. It was an incredibly important ceremony and celebration, and that we would always have it in our home. So the next year, they didn't ask us back. I don't know why. Steve says I sang too loud. but I have a good singing voice, so that wasn't it. Maybe he was gone by then. I should look it up. But anyway, I was pregnant for our first child, and so I said to Steve's parents, I made Steve say to his parents that they had to have a Seder. This was a huge shock. I mean, they had objected strenuously to our marriage. The last thing on earth they expected was for me to insist they have a Seder. And by the way, I'm sorry they're both gone, because we became wonderful, wonderful friends, and I love them very much, and they love me. But I'm sorry they died before I became a life member of Hadassah, which happened. Thank you. Just happened last week. I'm afraid about my first mailing. But at any rate, so Steve prevailed upon them, and they were good sports, and they had a little Seder. Steve's mother always said the first Seder she ever attended was one I insisted she have. And while we were, it was just the four of us with the classic Maxwell House Haggadah, And while we were at the table, Steve's twin brother called, and Steve's father sort of does this, "We can't talk right now, you know, we're having a Seder." And Mark says, "What? You know, you're having a what?" And Steve's father says, "Yes, we're having a Seder." And Mark says, "Why?" And Will says, "Because Cokie wanted it." And that was the truth. Because Steve was raised as a very secular Jew, very Jewish, very, very, very Jewish. His entire world was Jewish. But he, his grandparents, his father, his uncles had never been bar mitzvahed. Nobody had been married by a rabbi. The equivalent of religion for them was Zionism. One of his grandfathers had been a pioneer in Palestine. And socialism. The other grandfather went religiously to the workman's circle. And they were not only a-religious, they were really anti-religious. And so that was, but very culturally Jewish. And all of their friends were Jewish. Everybody they knew was Jewish. And it was embarrassing for him to marry me. And Steve's father did say at one point, "Well, it would be easier to oppose this if it weren't clear she's the perfect girl for you." But he still opposed it. But you know, got over it. But and finally found himself having this Seder. And they were good sports about it. But it was a new adventure for them. And by the next year, Steve and I were living in California. And it was clear that if Cokie wanted it, Cokie had to do it. And so I went to the neighboring temple and bought a little Haggadah, which was published by the Reconstructionist Society, and bought a Seder plate, the plate that holds the symbols of Passover, which I thought was something of a commitment. And it has traveled around the world with us and has one significant chip, but it's serving its purpose fine. And so that year we had our first in our home Seder. That would have been 1969. And we had our friends. We hadn't lived there very long, but we had friends who came in. And I know this will come as a surprise to some of you. They argued. There was a whole dispute about whether this was the right Seder and whether this was the right Haggadah and whether, you know, blah, 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 blah. And everybody had a view. So the next year I sat down with my little Smith Corona manual typewriter that I had been given as a high school graduation present and typed out our Haggadah and then mimeographed it. This room actually knows what mimeographing is. And basically that text is this now very beautiful book, our Haggadah, which we have used for 40-some years. Our friends in California came all the time, and it became so much a part of our existence and our time there, and symbolism of the familial and religious atmosphere that we wanted to incorporate in our lives, that when we left California to move to Greece, our friends gave us a Seder a month early as a going-away present. So that was very dear. But then we got to Greece, and we got there only a couple of weeks after Passover. And we were living in one of those little apartment hotels that you stay in, you know, when you move. And our children were 3 and 5. And Steve was, you know, bustling off to work like men do, pretending that they have more important things to do. It was a bad day for men when all of us went to work. And discovered it so much easier than being at home. I mean, I always say to women now, you know, that have maternity leave, "Oh, you poor dears, you know. It was wonderful to go back to work with a 10-day-old. Someone else was there." But at any rate, I said to Steve, it's Passover, and we'll have a little Seder, just the four of us here in the apartment. And there is an old synagogue in Athens. It's down at the foot of the Acropolis, where you'd expect it to be. And I said, I suspect that somewhere near the synagogue, there's somebody selling matzah, you know, because that's normally the case. And so would you please go and check it out? And I said, and if you can't find any matzah, why don't you get some pita bread? At least it's unleavened bread, you know. I mean, seriously, it's unleavened bread. So he, as he would tell the story, this is his part, he neglected his duties. Surprise. He suddenly realizes, you know, he's about to head home, and I'm preparing a Passover dinner, and he's got nothing. And I keep saying to him, you could have stayed with the children. You know, I would have been happy to go downtown. He doesn't like that part. And so he stops in on his way to our little Seder. He stops into a pastry shop. I mean, think of it. What more inappropriate place could you be? And picks up a cheesecake. I mean, truly, that's what happened. And he walks into our little, you know, space and says, here's a cheesecake. And I said, what are you thinking? You know, this is, I mean, come on, cheesecake. And he said, it's Jewish. I knew I was in trouble, but we had our little matzah-less and unleavened bread-less and cheesecake-filled Seder. But then we moved to our home, and we had some really significant and meaningful Seders in Greece with people coming from many different cultures, including a dear friend whose father had been drafted into the Nazi army and came very much as a symbol of reconciliation. And we did have one Egyptian friend who wasn't thrilled with the story, but although as Steve now says, you know, he constantly says he'd like to thank our press agent Hosni Mubarak, because of course what did just happen in Tahrir Square was very much a replication of the "Let My People Go" story, and that is true, which is one of the great universal themes of Passover. But we did have a couple that came all the time, and actually still come, and children come. There was a Foreign Service officer, Jewish fellow from Chicago, who on his first posting to Brazil had married a wonderful Brazilian Catholic woman, and their kids were the same age as our kids. And at the point in the ceremony when you send a child out to look for Elijah, which turns out I hadn't realized, it really does confuse children. They do expect him to show up. And so we sent Elisa out to find Elijah, and she didn't come back. And, I mean, she really didn't come back. Now, fortunately, Athens is really safe, but, you know, at some point we started to worry. And she finally came wandering in, and we said, Elisa, did you see Elijah? And she said, no, but I saw God. So Steve feels that was the high point. But we also sent our son Lee out one year when he was about 5 or 6. And, you know, he came back disappointed. And he finally pulled Steve aside, and he said, Dad, when you were a little boy and both of your parents were Jewish, did Elijah come to your house? he thought Elijah was boycotting the Shiksa. So, but at any rate, we then moved back to Washington, to the house I grew up in, where we live, and of course continued our Seders. And they just grew and grew and grew, because nobody wanted to stop coming. And fortunately, people had children, and they had children. And Steve's parents said, you know, essentially, just don't ask us. We're going to come. And they timed their migration from Florida, you know, around Passover. And my mother, of course, came every year, except for the years when she was the ambassador to the Vatican. And in those years, she missed it, although she went to many seders in Vatican City, but where the Israeli ambassador to the Vatican's name was Lopez, which is a whole wonderful story in its own self, which I'll tell you later if you want to know. But you know, when Mama went to the Vatican, we were all so excited because, you know, she was 81 years old, taking a new job in a new country. And we thought this is a great capstone to a career in public service where she can serve both her country and her church. And then, of course, what happened in this country happened. And my mother found herself representing Bill Clinton to the Pope. Now, yeah, think of it. It was the toughest job in the diplomatic service. But if anybody could do it, my mother could. She was well raised in New Orleans, which, you know, is able to take on pretty much anything. In fact, when my mother's home is on Bourbon Street, and right smack dab in the middle of all of the honky tonk on Bourbon Street. I mean, if you've been to Bourbon Street, you've been to Mama's house. And when she moved from Bourbon Street to the Vatican, I teased her that the costumes didn't change, you know. It was still guys in dresses, but that was true. But she dealt with them fine, too. She could do anything. As my sister used to say, my late sister, who was a New Jersey politician, used to say, you know, New Orleans Catholics are a certain breed, and we were raised to believe that God gave us the gift of life and that there is no greater joy that you can give a gift giver than to enjoy the gift. And therefore, we enjoy life. She made this speech once in public in some either New Jersey or Philadelphia paper, wrote it as a New Order Catholic as opposed to a New Orleans Catholic. And everybody kept trying to sign up. That is a true story. But at any rate, we had these seders, as they got bigger, there was no room in the house big enough to hold them. You know, for all the other holidays, I can just put people in rooms all over the house, but for Passover, everybody has to be in the same room. And so the only room that's even vaguely big enough is a glassed-in porch, and so we clear out the furniture and bring in these rented, you know, rectangular table, so it looks for all the world like a VFW hall. And we squeeze, and I mean squeeze, everybody in. But it is this wonderfully joyous occasion. And in fact, one year, Steve said, looking around at the crowd, and it really wasn't intentional. It's just, you know, who are our friends and what the world is like these days. He looked around and he said, I think my parents, turning to his parents, you're the only Jewish couple here. And Barney Frank looked at the guy next to him and said, no, he's Jewish. And so having had that experience below these 40-some years, we had been celebrating with our little Haggadah that was all typed up, and as I say, it was all covered with wine stains and all of that. And actually, one of our guests, who's a neighbor and a good friend, decided at one point that he was going to make it look better. So he asked me if there were any changes I wanted to make, and I did, you know, gender neutralize it even a little more. And the four sons are four children, but I've been fair. I didn't make both the simple one and the wicked one boys. But he then had someone else type up on a computer as opposed to, you know, my Smith Corona, the 25th anniversary edition, but still stapled together and all that. And it arrived at our tables a good while ago now, and everybody just hooted and hollered, "This is terrible, where are the Weinsteins? This isn't our Haggadah, what's going on?" But, you know, it took about a year for it to look disreputable. And they won't have anything to do with this. I mean, you know, this beautiful book, because they want the Weinsteins, which they will do to the book. I don't know what the problem is. But because we have been doing it for so long, we started to hear from people in the publishing world that it would be useful to put it between hardcovers and make it available at a wider scale. And even though there are, in fact, somewhere around 3,000 Haggadahs out there, I didn't feel there was a crying need. But there wasn't one that was specifically geared to interfaith families. And there wasn't one that tried to demystify just the practicalities of having a Passover dinner. I think people look at the pictures on the Maxwell House Classic and see a table that looks unfamiliar to them, just the way the table is set. And they worry about the food. How do they cook the food? And all of that. And what about the songs? Suppose they get the songs wrong. And if they don't know the tune, how do they do that? All of that. So we did sit down and do just a very practical book of here's how you set the table, here's where you buy a Seder plate. If you don't want to buy a Seder plate, here's what you do to substitute. Here's some recipes, and my recipes are the most simple-minded recipes you've ever seen, but they taste good. They are not brisket. They are lamb. Lamb, not ham. Lamb. And it does also have all the songs and websites where you can find sheet music and all kinds of stuff. So it's very practical. It also has, because in reading all of these many, many Haggadahs that I've read, they say over and over and over again, you know, you must tell the story of the Exodus to your children and your children's children on through the generations, which I'm all for. It's a wonderful story. Most Haggadahs do not include the story of the Exodus. They just say you should tell it. And so this one actually has the story of the Exodus straight from the Bible. And as we were putting it together, of course, we both did a good bit of research. And Steve, you know, Steve felt that he had never heard who, really, other than the fact that we read his name every year. He never knew who Rabbi Tarfon was, and so he's now there, explained as a great sage. But one of the things that Steve most liked learning was the part of the story of Moses, the sort of in-between part, because, of course, we all know the baby part, and we all know the end part. But the in-between part, after he has killed the Egyptian, because the Egyptian is, you know, is being brutal to a Jew, and has to flee the country, he goes to Midian, and it's now believed that Midian is Saudi Arabia. I keep thinking he could have stayed in Saudi Arabia, you know. And Steve says, "Milk and honey, oil. Milk and honey, oil." You know, I mean. Steve will always tell the joke at this point. If we were really the chosen people, why didn't we go to Kuwait? You know, but at any rate, while he was in Midian, he goes to a well, and there are girls, of course, collecting the water, as they still do all over the world today. And one of the girls goes home, and they're being harassed by a bunch of shepherds, and he drives away the shepherds. And then the girls go home to their father and say they've been saved by this stranger who drove away the shepherds. And the father says, "Well, that's terrible. You're being inhospitable. Why didn't you invite him to dinner?" Which Steve will now say, leading to one of the great Jewish commands, eat something. And so, of course, Moses goes to Jethro's home and marries his daughter Zipporah. And Zipporah turns out to be, of course, not Jewish, but according to most accounts, most likely a woman of color. So when we're talking about interfaith and mixed marriage, it goes back to Moses, at least. And then when God appears to him in the burning bush and says, you have to go to Egypt to save your people, she's very nervous because their son, Gershom, whose name means I was a stranger there, which is one of the great reasons that the Passover message is always that you should invite strangers in, because Moses said, I was a stranger in a strange land. When they're heading back to Egypt to save the Israelites, Zipporah realizes that Gershom is not circumcised, and so she's worried about that. So she takes a sharp rock, I know, and that's that story. But Steve had a really interesting time doing the research into all of this, and he included a lot of readings from all kinds of people on the subject of freedom, including Sitting Bull and Cesar Chavez and Pope John Paul and Susan B. Anthony, and, you know, and these are all, of course, optional. I also had a great deal of interest and fun in doing research into the Christian connections. Of course, when we were living in Greece, you absolutely couldn't, you couldn't not notice the tremendous echoes of the Passover story in Easter. Pascha, the Greek word for Easter, is also the Greek word for Passover. And, of course, the word Paschal comes from that. And all of the echoes of the Passover in the Easter liturgy are huge. You know, the Paschal lamb, the Paschal sacrifice, Jesus, our Passover, all of that. And many of the Psalms are the same. But in Greece, Easter is by far the biggest holiday. And when you go to a Greek Orthodox church in for midnight mass, you get there and the church is totally dark. It's totally spooky and dark. The priest walks in holding one little candle, and that's the only light in this whole stone structure. And then he lights a candle. And then that person takes the candle and lights a candle. And it goes one by one by one, candle by candle by candle, until the whole church is suffused with beautiful candlelight. And you hold your candle through the Mass, and then you walk out, and you walk back to your house. It's assumed that you're that close, and we were. And you get to your house, and you make, with the candle, you make a soot cross above your door, which is a direct reference to the Passover story of putting the blood of the lamb on the door so the angel would pass over and spare your firstborn son. So the echoes were very, very strong there. And of course, I knew that the Last Supper was a Seder and that the sacrament of the Eucharist was instituted at a Passover meal. And in fact, I didn't know that many scholars believe that the Eucharist itself, the first Eucharist, was the Afikoman of the Seder. But the other thing I didn't know was that the rabbis referenced in the Passover ceremony, Rabbi Hillel, Rabbi Gamaliel, were very influential men in Israel at the time of Jesus. Hillel was gone, but his school was very, very much part of the school of theology that Jesus and his disciples were part of. And Gamaliel was his grandson, and Paul was a student of Gamaliel, something that he used, you read about it in the Acts of the Apostles, where he says, you know, I am Gamaliel's student. I am, he used it as to show his bona fides as a good Jew. And so these men who we year after year after year talk about in the Seder were men who were very, very influential at the time of Jesus, and particularly at the time of the founding of the church. So the connections are very strong indeed. Now, having said that, that's all by way of commentary. I feel very, 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 very strongly that as much as the ceremony and the message of Passover is a universal message, it is the message of going from bondage to freedom, from death to life, from darkness to light, which is, of course, exactly the same message of Easter. And it is a message that resonates with all peoples all over the world throughout all time. Having said that, I still feel very strongly that this is a Jewish holiday, and this is a Jewish festival. And we should not attempt in any way to Christianize Passover, to baptize it in any way. Jews throughout history for thousands of years around the world, often at great personal peril, have been celebrating, commemorating this festival, and asking throughout the world, why is this night different? And so I feel very strongly that the ceremony itself remained true to the Jewish ceremony and respect the fact that it is a Jewish custom. But as I was reading about sort of attitudes and teachings about Judaism modern Catholicism, I found a letter from the Catholic bishop saying exactly what I had just said about, because there are now seders held in many churches around the country, but saying this is not, we should not Christianize, baptize a seder. This is a Jewish event, and we should respect it. But they also add, we must accept our responsibility to prepare the world for the coming of the Messiah by working together for social justice, respect for the rights of persons and nations, and for social and international reconciliation. To this we are driven, Jews and Christians, by the command to love our neighbor, by a common hope for the kingdom of God, and by the great heritage of the prophets. That's what it's all about. That's what religion in its best sense is all about. That's what being human beings is all about. And what Passover is all about is having the freedom to be able to do that, to be the kinds of people we want to be people who take social responsibility, work for justice and for international reconciliation, so that the whole world can be free and celebrate this wonderful, wonderful festival that's meaningful to all of us, and that I have had the great privilege of being able to participate in for lo these 40 years. So with those thoughts, I would love to take your questions. Thank you very much. Thank you. Questions? You're bound to have questions. It's the Philadelphia Free Library. I see a couple right in the middle here.
Have you embraced,
or
can we wait for the microphone?
You have to wait for the microphone.
Thank you for a great talk, by the way.
Thank you.
Have you and your husband or your children embraced other aspects of Judaism, like Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah?
Oh, yes. My husband says his mother was right. He should have married a Jewish girl. She wouldn't have made him go to temple on Rosh Hashanah. But But actually, he's gotten so good at it that last year at Rosh Hashanah, he gave the sermon. So that was terrific. And we have a big Hanukkah, which is right before our big Christmas most years. It's a lot of cooking and presents. So our kids, of course, were in ecstasy. And when they were small, we did Purim. And of course, for me, that was so much like Mardi Gras. It was a lot of fun. And I noticed this year for the first time in my favorite catalog, The Source for Everything Jewish, that all the Purim decorations were purple, green, and gold, which are the Mardi Gras colors. So there you go. Other questions? There's one, there are a bunch of them.
What's happened to your children vis-a-vis this experience?
Our children, who of course are now middle-aged, very much are respecters of both traditions, and very much would prefer us to respect their privacy. They feel strongly that we lead a public life; they do not. And so, I will just say that they are wonderful human beings who are very steeped in both traditions and feel very strongly about them.
Would you speak to how your husband adapted to Christianity and how you've blended it from that direction?
You know, that is such a, I'm so glad you asked that, because he feels very strongly that he's a professor at George Washington. He counsels a lot of kids. And he feels that he often hears the Jewish partners say, well, you know, the other one has to learn about my faith. And he doesn't feel that there's a lot of reciprocity there. And he feels strongly that the Jewish partner has the same obligation to learn about the Christian or whatever the other partner's faith is. And he's done a pretty good job of it, and he certainly supports me strongly. And he comes to Christmas and Easter, and he has no, I mean, it's hard to avoid. But he also says very sweetly, and it's kind of sort of embarrassing for me to say this. One of the things that was very clear when we were young, and started dating, was that one of the things we loved about each other was how connected to our traditions we were, and how much our families were part of our lives. I revealed to him many decades later that when I was 18, I knew he'd be a wonderful grandfather. Now, if I had told him that then, he would have gone running so fast. But he is a wonderful grandfather. But I knew that because I could see how connected to his family he was and how important that was to him. And that was important to me. And he would say that one of the things he loves about me is my faith and my upbringing by the Religious of the Sacred Heart, with whom I am still very connected. I was at the Sacred Heart School at Bryn Mawr today, and that they're raising me to be the kind of person I am is the reason that he loves me as much as he does, and that he has learned that that is a key part of who I am, and that it would be such a mistake to try to want me to be anything else.
Thank you very much, Koki, for the talk. How did you and Steve meet, and when you think about the discussions and the upset and things that you're trying to figure out at 18 and 19, looking back, how much were those the right questions? you were asking, how much of it was really didn't turn out to be the big questions, and sort of what your perspective is on that now.
Yeah, that's a good question. We met at a student political meeting at Ohio State University, the National Student Association. He was at Harvard, I was at Wellesley. And we went back to our schools, and he asked me out a couple of times, and then he didn't call again because he was a jerk. And but then we went to another political meeting in Washington in the spring of 1963, and have really pretty much been together ever since. There was lots of upset and lots of tears, and all of that. It was much easier for my family than for his, because my family was much more cosmopolitan, and it was the majority culture. But at any rate, we did have endless conversations, and I think it was a good thing to do, because we worked through some serious issues as very young people that became a template for the rest of our marriage. And from there on out, we have never had a fight about religion. We've had plenty of fights, but not about religion. So I think it was a very useful thing to do. And I think it's a mistake to think, oh, it's all going to be fine, and not talk about it. You can also make a mistake the other way of sort of trying to figure out every step of the way, because life is not like that. Life interrupts. But they were useful questions to ask, and I think they served a very useful purpose. When we had been married about 10 years, I thought, well, wasn't it crazy for us to be so so concerned about these things, you know? How could anything interrupt our true love? And when we had been married about 10 years more than that, I thought, boy, was it smart of us to care about these things. Because these are important questions, and they do have a lot to do about who you are. And if in fact Steve's family had said, we'll have nothing more to do with you if you marry that girl, I wouldn't have married him, because he would have not been who he is. He would have been cut off, and it would have been terrible. So I think those are important questions to ask. Has it had an effect on our life day in and day out? Not as much as opening the window and closing the window. Of course not. I think he opens the window to try to kill me. But I think it was a very useful set of conversations to have. And look, the reason we did this is because what we're looking at now in America is, you know, there's not a family in this room that doesn't have somebody who's married to somebody who wasn't who they were. And in Jewish families, it's about 50% of Jewish young people marrying people who are not Jewish. In big cities, it can be 70%. And in America as a whole, one out of seven marriages are interracial marriages. And even if you're talking about intra-religious marriages, you look at the bands of marriage posted in the Catholic Church, and it will be somebody Diem marrying somebody Gopez, you know, Lopez. So you have tremendous intermarriage in this country, because that's America. You know, people come to this country, they meet each other, they fall in love. Funny thing about love. And doing that is not turning your back on your family and your tradition. It's turning your face toward this person you love and hoping your family is with you in profile and can be with you on this journey. And that is true around the country in all kinds of ways and all kinds of permutations and combinations. And it's being recognized much, 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 much more in Judaism than it ever was before. Now you do find rabbis marrying people. And the Jewish Theological Seminary has courses on interfaith reach out and all of that, because they understand that saying no to this is just driving people away. People are still going to marry each other. Having the rabbi or the priest say, we're not going to marry you, doesn't mean they don't get married. They marry. Funny thing. Love. And so we don't proselytize here. We don't have a position. All we're trying to do is say, if you do this, try to respect each other, try to understand each other, try to make it possible for you to celebrate each other, not hurt each other. And that's what we have found works for us, works differently for different people. But there's no reason for anybody not to be able to celebrate and honor the fabulous tradition of Passover.
Excuse me.
I'm hearing one more. The hook isn't coming over here.
you only.
Where are you?
I'm here.
Thank you.
You only mentioned your wonderful, prolific professional life in one conflict, the trip to Tel Aviv. Could you just discuss that a little bit? Because you not only had a personal life to deal with, but two religious lives.
I don't know. I don't understand the question.
Whether it was difficult to combine your extremely active professional life with an extremely active family and religious life?
Well, sure it was, but you know, first of all, I write history books. And I think anybody who thinks it's hard to combine things and do things and all that stuff that they do today is just a sissy. I mean, the women that I write about from the 18th and early 19th centuries, and now I'm moving into the mid-19th century, had really hard lives. And they had to combine raising families and doing incredible social work. They founded the entire social safety net of this country without any legal or political rights. And they would have children, you know, yellow fever would come through Philadelphia and kill a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old in 1 week. And think how hard it was just to get through daily life. And they had strong religious lives. And if you don't think they had professional lives, it's because history hasn't taught it properly. They had very strong professional lives. Look at Rebecca Gratz, what she did in Philadelphia to found the first Hebrew orphanage. She had already worked founding the Philadelphia orphanage with the Christian women, then the first Hebrew orphanage, then the entire Hebrew education system throughout the United States of America. That's a professional life. And it might not have been called that, but that's what it was. And, you know, women have been doing this from time out of mind, and I just think we get all sort of squishy about how it's so hard, when, in fact, yes, it's hard, but it's nowhere near as hard as it was for our foremothers. So buck up. Well, thank you all so much for being here. I love coming here. Now, I have to tell you, wait a minute. I have to tell you one other thing. I had a lovely dinner that Bill Sasso hosted up in the fabulous Rare Book Room with the lovely people who give their time and their treasure to this institution. But I want to talk to you for just a second about how incredibly important it is to do this right now at this moment in history, because our libraries are doing more important work than ever before. People are coming in who need jobs. They come to our librarians and they say, please help me with my resume. They use the internet in the libraries to look for jobs. They keep the libraries open looking for that. They are using the services of the libraries more than ever before. Meanwhile, the librarians are having to learn more and more about how to deal with e-books, how to help people access the internet. I use that as a verb, dear. And don't tell the nuns. And the and community groups are coming into the libraries because other buildings are closing down to them. Groups like AA and rent associations, all kinds of groups. And at the same time that that is happening, when these tremendous services are being provided by our libraries, the cutbacks from our cities and states are huge. So libraries are having to do much, much, much more work and much, much more important work with fewer and fewer resources. So please keep coming. Please keep contributing. I can't say enough how important this is. That's why I'm here tonight, and I'm awfully glad you're here. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.